What is nationalism? Is it akin to patriotism? Is it inherently bad? Well, that all depends on how you interpret an ideology that promotes the interests of a national people. Some forms of nationalism, like Nazi German nationalism, are quite easy to condemn. Others are more complicated, filled with contradictions, good and noble things, as well as evil and atrocious things. Such is the case with respect to Irish nationalism. Hello, folks. I'm Ian Balmer, and today we're going to talk about the long history and evolution of Irish nationalism. Now let's start this podcast by laying down the foundation for the beginnings of Irish nationalism. In the years of the English Civil War, the English had possessed a significant established rule in Ireland dating all the way back to the 12th century, with the Earl of Pembroke and the vindictive turncoat Diarmuid Mac Murchada's successful incursion into Ireland. Before the Reformation, a non-religious Irish national identity manifested itself in conflicts like the Tyrone Rebellion. However, a very rigid and defined elite of Protestants was created during the English Civil War during Oliver Cromwell's reign. A coalition of Irish Catholics formed in the 1641 O'Neill Rebellion under Felim O'Neill and Rory O'More, and established a Catholic confederation. The supposed brutality of this confederation against Protestants was conveyed to the Parliament by the Irish Lords in 1641. Quote, "All the Protestants in the kingdom were never in so great danger to be lost at this instant, no age having produced in this kingdom an example of so much mischief done in so short a time as we now find acted here. By killing and destroying so many English and Protestants in several parts, by robbing and spoiling of them and many thousands more, and all their wickedness acted against the English and Protestants with so much inhumanity and cruelty as cannot be imagined from Christians even towards infidels," end quote. Oliver Cromwell was dispatched to deal with this Catholic confederation in what would become the Confederate War. Cromwell gave a bad name to the English in Ireland due to responding to the Catholic brutality with some of his own. His bloodiness at the Siege of Drogheda is particularly noted. He was quoted with saying, quote, "He who could take Drogheda could take hell," end quote, before his army killed between 3,000 and 4,000 people in the city. Catholic clergy were specifically targeted, as many priests were burnt in their parish churches. To quote one burning man during the Siege of Drogheda, "God damn me, God confound me, I burn," end quote. Cromwell supposedly conveyed these words back to Parliament in an official report without a fiber of emotion. But this podcast is not a historiographical critique of Cromwell's cruelty, so let's not digress. The importance of these details shows that there is a clear religious delineation that is seen throughout a predominant amount of history. This Gaelic Irish Catholic group and the traditional Old English Catholics now experienced acrimony from the Protestant elite that had established itself after these wars. Religion had finally become a clear criterion of the Irish national identity and continues to be so today. Never again would there be a Catholic monarch ruling over the British Isles after the Glorious Revolution. The Glorious Revolution of 1688 prompted the ascendance of Protestant monarchs William and Mary to the throne. William was of the House of Orange, but had a legitimate claim to the throne due to him being the nephew and son-in-law of the Catholic King, James II of England and 7th of Scotland. While the process of deposing James was relatively bloodless, the series of wars between the Jacobites, or supporters of the Catholic James in Ireland and Scotland, and the Williamites, or supporters of Protestant William, cost many lives. But the Williamites were triumphant, which led to a constant emphasis on religion in Ireland due to the conflictual relationship between the majority Catholic population and its Protestant rulers. Acting on their prejudices against the Catholics, new elites enacted discriminatory legislation. Under English Protestant law, Catholic landowners had their property dispossessed. Quote-unquote, papists could not hold public office or be guardians to Protestant children. And most importantly, Catholics could not vote. All these de jure discriminations added fuel to the fire of Catholic resentment towards the ruling English Protestant class, and thus to the development of us-versus-them mentality in the minds of Irish Catholics, who began to see their religion as a component of a new national identity. Irish nationalism gained serious political traction in the vehicles of British government in the late 18th century. Just before the Act of Union 1801 that combined the kingdoms of Ireland and Great Britain into one sovereign entity, we finally see the stirrings of a stronger national political identity begin to form in Ireland. Henry Flood, a member of the Irish House of Commons, formed the Irish Patriot Party in the 1760s. However, the most notable politico from this party was Henry Grattan. While maintaining his loyalty to the crown, Grattan campaigned for more autonomy for the Irish Parliament and called for Catholic emancipation, or the removal of all forms of legal discrimination against Catholics in the whole of the British Isles. There was some success with respect to Catholic emancipation during the time of Grattan, as the Roman Catholic Relief Act 1793 enfranchised a large amount of property-owning or property-renting Catholics and gave them the right to practice law at the great reluctance of William Pitt the Younger, Prime Minister, but not all discrimination was lifted. And not all attempts to establish defined Irish sovereignty during this time were peaceful or legislative. In France, the Enlightenment had swayed revolutionaries to disregard the importance of religion in life, and the magnitude of this secular revolution that started in 1789 would find its way to Ireland just 9 years later in 1798. For the first time in years, Catholics and non-elite Protestants had coalesced into one group to fight for the nationhood of Ireland. The Society of United Irishmen, led by Wolfe Tone, launched a rebellion against the British in 1798 with the intention to declare an independent Irish Republic, but were ultimately defeated. Even though it's generally taboo to academically dive into alternate history, one of the greatest what-ifs of this time period is what would have happened if the 1798 rebellion had taken place 2 years earlier as planned, with the help of a French expedition under General Lazare Hoche, a contemporary of Napoleon who some considered to be of equal skill to Bonaparte. However, these plans were thwarted by a mixture of a massive storm that threw off the French invasion force and the War of the First Coalition against France, which diverted a tremendous amount of the nation's focus from Ireland towards defending the Rhineland and pressing forward with Napoleon's aggressive campaign in northern Italy. Though Wolfe Tone and the United Irishmen were defeated, Tone is often considered the father of Irish nationalism due to his significant legacy as an Irish rebel of the highest caliber. The year 1801 was a major blow to many Irish nationalists. Ireland, Scotland, and England had all been under the personal union of the Crown of England, just like Corsica was under the personal union of the French crown after it was purchased from the Republic of Genoa. In 1707, the personal union between Scotland and England was dissolved by an act of union, and the two kingdoms became one under a sovereign union. A similar set of acts was proposed in 1800 to do the same with Ireland, and many Irish nationalists were opposed to these bills for a number of reasons. Many thought that they would make the governance of Ireland more directly controlled by the crown. Others thought that they would facilitate more discrimination towards Catholics. And the most outspoken opponents of these bills objected to the fact that the Parliament of Ireland would be abolished, even if Ireland would now receive representation in Westminster. Grattan was one of the most ardent critics of the bill, stating in 1800 that, quote, "You are to have not what is miscalled a union, still less a union in a constitution of liberty, but a subordinate Irish government without control of a parliament. The inferiority, the expense, the patronage of a second and secondary government. This breach of compact, for such I must call it, this surrender of liberty, for it is nothing less, this transfer of power of this country to Great Britain is made at a time of constitutional debility and division," end quote. Despite the tooth-and-nail resistance of men like Grattan, the act passed in both the Dublin and Westminster parliaments, and many members of the Irish Parliament, including Grattan, became MPs in Westminster. However, Ireland would find itself more easily subjected to the Crown's scrutiny after the Acts of Union were passed. I earlier mentioned the fact that Wolfe Tone and the United Irishmen had both Protestants and Catholics among their ranks. This is where the distinction of religion becomes most important, due to the fact that in the time period of the late 1830s to the late 1840s, we start to see two schools of Irish nationalism emerge. Daniel O'Connell was one of the first Catholics who began to practice law after they were permitted to do so by the Act of 1793. He was also one of the first Catholics to fight for the full, entire legal emancipation of the sect. Enfranchisement and a slight relaxation of the discrimination against the Catholic community led to a surge of self-realization within said community, and this self-realization extended itself to the political realm. O'Connell founded the Catholic Association in 1823 and vigorously campaigned for the ability of Catholics to sit in Parliament. Facing the same pressure that Pitt the Younger faced in 1793, Prime Minister Arthur Wesley, the Duke of Wellington and the hero of Waterloo, signed off on the Roman Catholic Relief Act, 1829, just 6 years after O'Connell had created his Catholic Association. Years later, O'Connell would lead a dominant Irish nationalist faction in Westminster, and his next goal would be to repeal the Act of Union, 1801, to ensure Irish sovereignty. Speaking to a large rally in Drogheda, the same site of Cromwell's massacre, he stated, quote, "I want to make all Europe and America know it. I want to make England feel her weakness if she refuses to give the justice we the Irish require, the restoration of our domestic parliament." O'Connell's attempt at this sort of Garrisonian disunionism was attempted through his Repeal Association. Although the main goal of the association failed, the political tact of O'Connell rallied a large group of Irishmen to adopt and reinforce his ideology. Using tactics like monster meetings or large rallies and tithe wars to resist Catholic tithes to Anglican communion, O'Connell not only developed one of the major schools of Irish nationalism and solidified its logistical efficacy, but he earned the support of the Catholic Church in Ireland. The first Irish cardinal to Rome, Archbishop Paul Cullen, wholeheartedly threw his support behind O'Connell. However, this strong Catholic political scheming fostered hostility amongst the Protestants of the British Isles. They viewed this growing Catholic power as an existential threat to the status quo, and thus the union of Protestants and Catholics that was seen in the rebellion of 1798 slowly began to wane and gave way to sectarian prejudice that would go on to manifest itself into greater issues in the 20th century. The other school of Irish nationalism was, on the whole, much less moderate than O'Connell's church-endorsed political machine. The Young Ireland Association originally stemmed from O'Connell's Repeal Association, but did not place as much emphasis on Catholicism. The romantic nationalism of the 1840s would culminate in the Spring of Nations all across Europe, and Ireland was no exception. The ideals of Romanticism slowly crept into the views of the Young Irelanders, who focused more on their national identity than their religious identity. In fact, one of their leaders was Thomas Davis, a Trinity College Dublin graduate who was not only a Protestant, but a descendant of the Cromwell family. The amalgamation of mostly Catholics, but also Protestants, in the Young Irelanders focused on a secular republic that would be earned by means of physical force. Indeed, such an attempt to achieve a republic by violent means was undertaken in 1848, coinciding with popular revolutions in continental European countries like France, Prussia, and the Italian states. This Young Irelander rebellion was defeated by the British after one engagement in Ballingarry, County Tipperary, but would come to embody violence, a hallmark of this branch of Irish nationalism. We know it today as Irish republicanism. Both forms of Irish nationalism would be influenced by one of the most cataclysmic events of the 19th century, the Great Famine. Many angry Irishmen blamed the British for their problems, and part of the cause for the 1848 revolt is speculated to be the Great Famine. The Great Famine was caused by a potato blight, which devastated the harvest of the potato, the most important sustenance crop on the entire island. The source of the blight is not known for sure, but many historians speculate it came from one of the two American continents. The famine arguably could have been avoided, as the Irish had a heavy potato monoculture and did not form a variety of crops that would allow them a safety net in case one crop failed. But what happened in the past is what happened. People were starving and angry at the British government for not providing adequate relief. The famine officially ended in 1849, but its effects massively reverberate through Irish history, as so many people left Ireland or died that the population of Ireland today still has not eclipsed its pre-famine levels. From the remnants of the era of O'Connell, the famine, and the Young Irelanders, new nationalist groups emerged. What was left of the Young Irelanders was absorbed into the Irish Republican Brotherhood, informally known as the Fenians and founded by James Stephens in 1858. The Fenians, like their Young Irelander predecessors, would try the way of armed revolt once again. Working with the Irish-American group Clan na Gael, they organized a joint attack on Britain and her territory of Canada in 1867. However, the attacks of 1867 that were really meant to be a rising utterly failed due to the lack of organization by Fenian leadership and the success of British police informants within the organization. However, there was some cultural significance to these attacks. One group of Fenians attempted to free the in-custody Fenian leaders Thomas Kelly and Timothy Deasy and killed a Manchester police officer in the process. The three Fenians responsible for the crime, William Philip Allen, Michael Larkin, and Michael O'Brien, were executed. This caused an outrage. As Friedrich Engels noted in one of his letters to Karl Marx in 1867, quote, "The only thing that the Fenians still lacked were martyrs. Only the execution of the three has made the liberation of Kelly and Deasy the heroic deed, which will now be sung to every Irish babe in the cradle in Ireland, England, and America. The Fenians could not have wished for a better precedent," end quote. Referring to John Brown and his execution for his raid on Harper's Ferry before the American Civil War, Ingalls continued, quote, "The Southerners had at least the decency to treat J. Brown as a rebel, whereas here everything is being done to transform a political attempt into a common crime," end quote. Indeed, the Manchester Martyrs became an immemorable story in Irish history and would go on to inspire songs like God Save Ireland and leaders like Charles Stuart Parnell. Parnell plays into a very important movement that evolved from a clamor for reform caused directly by the famine. While the Fenians waged literal war, other nationalists were waging economic war. The famine had enraged Irish tenants who starved, especially those tenants with absentee landlords. One Fenian had decided to devote himself to the nationalist cause by addressing these tenants' concerns. Michael Davitt founded the Irish Land League in 1878, which endeavored to mandate the, quote, "permanent fixture of the tenant in the soil," end quote, eviction only on non-payment of rent, right of sale of interest by the tenant, and the establishment of local land tribunals in the valuation of rent. Working with Member of Parliament William O'Brien, multiple acts of legislation would be written to placate the growing power of the Land League. However, none of this legislation would have passed without the help of one Charles Stuart Parnell. Parnell was a walking paradox, a vehement Irish nationalist, yet a Protestant landowner. Nonetheless, Parnell worked with Davitt, the Land League, and O'Brien to successfully gain rights for Irish tenants. Parnell would be the major political force of Irish nationalism as the leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party until 1891, and would be a major player in the Home Rule movement that was started by Isaac Butt in 1870. Butt was also a Protestant like Parnell, but a majority of the Home Rule League's members and constituents were Catholic. The Home Rule League, which would eventually be run by Parnell, wanted a fully autonomous self-government for Ireland. The most staunch opponents of Home Rule were Ulster Unionists, typically Protestant. Their most famous slogan read, quote, "Home rule is Rome rule," end quote, alluding to the overwhelming influence of Catholics in the government and the fear of the Vatican having a foothold in the British Isles upon the creation of an autonomous Ireland. Many liberal and conservative members of Parliament were also opposed to it, even though William Ewart Gladstone, Prime Minister at the time, approved of the idea. However, Parnell would not win Home Rule during his time as leader of the Parliamentary Party. Before moving forward, we should probably clarify the seemingly paradoxical fact that many Irish nationalist leaders were Protestants, despite the fact that an overwhelming majority of Irish nationalists after the era of Wolfe Tone were Catholics. After the defeats of the United Irishmen in 1798 and the Young Irelanders in 1848, most of the secularism of Irish nationalism significantly waned, and the degree to which Irish nationalists held a Catholic identity became much greater. Now, in history, two things are axiomatic. There are almost never absolutes, and there are almost always exceptions to rules. Now, we can say that almost all Irish nationalists were Catholic, but we can't say that every single one of them was. This is because Protestant figures like Parnell and Butt were exceptions to the rule that Irish nationalists are entirely Catholic. These exceptions do not, however, change the fact that Irish nationalism, from the latter half of the 19th century forward, was seen as a Catholic movement by its opponents, who were almost all nearly Protestant, and remain so to this day. The last thing we'll cover on this podcast before the end of the 19th century is how Irish nationalism played into a cultural revival of Gaelic-Irish traditions. Now, this was a slow but certainly steady process that began in the times of O'Connell, but it really soared in the times of the Fenians and Parnell. And this revival of Gaelic practices is called by historians to be
the Gaelic Revival. Now, while O'Connell was fighting for Irish rights in Parliament during the 1830s and 40s, he didn't campaign very much for the revival of the Irish language, despite his nationalist leanings. In fact, O'Connell did not see the declining use of the Irish language during his time to be a very pressing issue, as he admitted that, quote, "the superior utility of the English tongue as the medium of all modern communication is so great that I can witness without a sigh the gradual disuse of Irish," end quote. However, not all Irish nationalists were as complicit to the Anglicization of Ireland as O'Connell. The Gaelic League is the most popular example of this. It was formed in 1893 by Owen MacNeill, a historian of early and medieval Ireland. Its first president, Douglas Hyde, was very explicit in what his organization's goals were. In an 1892 lecture entitled, "The Necessity for the De-Anglicizing of the Irish People," he called for the strengthening of the Irish language and the arrest of the growth of what he saw to be a vulgar, commercial English culture. The Gaelic Athletic Association was also founded in 1884 by a group of Irishmen who were frequent players of billiards, a table sport with strong English influence. The yoke of English influence over sports in Ireland would be no longer, as the new Gaelic Athletic Association would promote hurling, carmogie, Gaelic football, Gaelic handball, and rounders. Well, I think we've reached a natural stopping point here at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. I hope you've learned a lot about the topic, and I hope you've enjoyed this podcast. In the 1900s, things get much more violent and much more complicated for Irish nationalism, with enough content to be discussed in another episode. Perhaps I'll release another one. Ireland gains its independence, and it goes through a massive time and upheaval. Well, perhaps we'll talk about that soon. But until next time, I'm Ian Bomber, and this has been The Evolution and History of Irish Nationalism from 1275 to 1900. Thank you.